I'm Michael Goldfarb in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Yesterday, President Bush reiterated his claim that Syria was a sponsor of state terrorism and warned the regime of President Bashar Assad it would be held accountable if it continued. Nothing new there. This week, The New Yorker magazine publishes a piece by veteran investigative reporter Seymour Hersh detailing productive contacts between U.S. and Syrian intelligence dating from the post-September 11th period, which have dried up in the aftermath of the Iraq War. Nothing new in the synchronous timing of Hersh's article. At regular intervals throughout the last year, as the American government prepared its troops and public for the toppling of the Saddam Hussein regime, Hersh has written about disquiet in the CIA over the politicization of its reports, the bureaucratic restraints on its work, and the accuracy of some of the intelligence the president has referred to in public, like Iraqi agents trying to buy yellowcake uranium from Niger in order to build nuclear weapons. Connection listeners, is the practice of fitting intelligence to suit policy objectives new? Has the American intelligence community fairly or unfairly lost credibility in the current drama surrounding those now infamous 16 words? And what will it take for you to regain your faith in U.S. intelligence? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me today from the NPR studio is in Washington is New Yorker writer Seymour Hersh. He's been a journalist for more than 30 years, covering topics including the My Lai massacre, Henry Kissinger's various deeds, and the CIA's bombing of Cambodia. And he's won numerous prizes for his work, including the Pulitzer Prize.
You didn't know he did all that.
And my other guest in the studio with Cy Hersh is Frank Anderson. He's currently Senior Vice President of Foreign Reports, a Washington consulting firm that concentrates on Middle East issues. And Mr. Anderson worked for the CIA from 1968 till 1995, spent 13 years overseas, including three tours as a CIA chief of station in various Middle East posts from 1991 until his retirement. He was chief of the Near East and South Asia Division. And I welcome you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to be here.
And that was, who was that who said good morning?
I did, Frank Anderson.
I said glad to be here.
Thanks. So we have this wonderful thing where you guys sound very much alike. So We'll sort out the intelligence. I'm at a distance from you, but I'll be able to tell the difference by the end of the program. Let me start with you, Cy Hersh, in this week's New Yorker. And Connection listeners, if you are at a desk and you're listening on your computer, you can actually read this week's New Yorker online. Just go to our website, www.theconnection.org, and you'll see a link to Cy Hersh's article. Why don't you quickly summarize this article on the Syrian connection, which seems to be fragmenting?
Well, the big point is that after 9/11, the new government, the head of Syria, Bashar Assad, he's the son of Hafez Assad, the old-time hardline dictator, tough guy of Syria. He took over after his father's death 3 years ago, and I think he wants to change things. He's younger, much younger, in his 30s. And he wants to be more progressive. He's got a lot of problems. He's got an old guard. He's got corruption. And after 9/11, he took an initiative that was very much welcomed by us. His country has been at war with the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, which came in much later, for 20 years, dating back to the late 70s, actually. There's been a lot of terrorism against the regime of Syria by radical fundamentalist groups, Islamic groups. And so they had had files. They had files that they knew an awful lot. They knew about the 19 guys that were in there. They knew about other people who wanted to play. They had penetrated quite a bit, and they really coughed up a lot. There was an incredible George Bush responded to us on a letter from Assad or a call from Assad, and the CIA began a liaison. FBI guys were also involved, and my friends in the intelligence community said it was incredibly helpful and fruitful, particularly in the first few months after 9/11. Files were given to us. We set up exploitation stations in a place called Aleppo in northern Syria, where people like Mohammed Atta, one of the main players of the September the 11th tragedy, was located, going to graduate school there. And they just began to throw us and put us into the picture of the Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda. And it was a very enthusiastic and fruitful relationship that a lot of people in the community liked very much.
And then what happened?
Well, what happened is that the inevitable tension is Syria did not support us in the war. They're Arab nationalists. That's been a longstanding tradition. Maybe I think Assad, it's fair to say, probably made a mistake. He should have gone with us, but he didn't.
Well, his father backed, just for some history, did back the U.S. in the first Gulf War.
Yes, of course. Then we had a U.N. coalition. It was a different situation. Here we were going in by ourselves, and there wasn't a coalition for him to hang on to. And he didn't want to. I think the Syrians always see themselves as special in the Arab world. They see themselves as an elite, as a leader of Arab mm-hmm. thought. And Arab nationalism, too. Anyway, for whatever reason, he didn't join us. He's also has had a strong relationship with a number of fundamentalists. He's very anti-Israel, although he and his father both are more than willing to negotiate on the Golan Heights, the longstanding mm-hmm. problem. In any case, what happened is simply this. We put pressure on him to, among other things, stop dealing with Iraq. There's been a longstanding exchange, sort of illicit smuggling, what you will, business exchange between Syria and Iraq, although they don't like each other, the leadership doesn't like each other. There's no way Assad is a fan of Hussein. But we put pressure on him to stop. We wanted him to do some operational stuff inside Iraq that he didn't want to do as a good Arab nationalist. And eventually it was decided by the conservatives and the neoconservatives, the Cheney, we have to put the president in there, Rumsfeld, the civilian leadership of the Pentagon, that it was more important to crunch down on Syria than to continue the intelligence. And the intelligence connection disappeared over the next few months.
Now, was this intelligence, I mean, was it back channel? Was it, as they say, I mean, was it, you know, only for a few eyes to know about, or was it generally known?
Oh, I think Mr. Anderson will tell you that he knew, I'm sure he's known from his own contacts, that there's been a lot of, you know, we've had a CIA station's been in Syria for many years with varying degrees. In 1991, we established, before the Gulf War, we established a secret relationship with Syria. They were going to take care of our pilots in case they got shot down. There's been a lot of stuff going on. Syria played a role in the 1970 negotiations with Henry Kissinger and ending the impasse there, or trying to, in Lebanon. So Syria has been useful, helpful when it wants to be. It also does support Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorist groups that attack Israel. It also is a supporter of Hezbollah, as Richard Armitage called, the A-team, that's our Deputy Secretary of State of Terrorists, in southern Lebanon. So it has a lot of influence to play in the Middle East talk process and certainly in the Arab-Israeli peace talks. But the issue for us was Iraq. We wanted him to do more, Assad, than he was willing to do. And the point is, it's the way I put it, it's the ideology turned out to be much more important than the actual practicality of getting good intelligence on what really should be the main target of this country, which is Al-Qaeda, Islamic terrorism. They're still out there. They still exist. We see this happening in Afghanistan right now. The Taliban are back. We really should be more focused. And
let me just stop you there, Zion, and bring Frank Anderson into this conversation, because the picture you've just painted, you know, we've got choices, and the choices are clearly being made, in your view, on, doctrinaire reasons rather than just objectively wanting to get the most intelligence from an Arab country that is in a unique position to provide this intelligence. Frank, that kind of choice, is that a new choice or is that one that you're very familiar with from all your years working in the CIA?
No, it's not at all new. In fact, one of the unintended consequences of developing an intelligence service, or at least a clandestine capability, is that you have an institution that can deal with countries discreetly or secretly, and it is almost always the case that the first ties between formerly unfriendly countries that are about to become friendly are in the intelligence channel, and the last ones to be broken when things go bad or in that channel. So this isn't new. As Cy and you both pointed out, this has been a repeated part of our relationship with Syria. We come in and come out of contact with them. To some extent, I have to put Syria in the same box that South Asian specialist Stephen Cohen has described Pakistan as, a country where at any given time, or in the best of times, the United States and Syria, or the United States and Pakistan, are between divorces. We've had these moments when our interests coincide. Certainly in the war on terrorism, I think they coincide more than on any other issue. we, the United States, made geopolitical choices and decided that more vigorous support for war on Iraq was more important than vigorous support for a war on terrorism. Those are policy choices, not the kinds of things that intelligence agencies make. They try very hard to participate in the process and to influence those decisions, but they don't make them.
Cy Hirsch, do you think that this particular administration is doing no more or no less than other administrations over the last, 35 years, which covers the period that you've been reporting on this sort of thing?
No, I think there's a huge difference here, which is the ideology. In this case, what happened is the buildup for the war began. And as the war began, in the first weeks it was very successful, Donald Rumsfeld in particular began to speak publicly about Syria. And the message in essence was, not quite as crudely as I'm stating it, but you're next, buddy. You're on the list. And I do think one of the things that's not clear to me and shouldn't, and really is very unnerving in a way, is what is the policy? What really is going on with this administration? In other words, is Iraq sort of the equivalent of St. Lo on the way to Berlin, the World War II, going country by country? Is it going to be Iraq and then Syria, then Iran, and then North Korea and then China? We don't know what the ultimate – is there an ultimate policy? In this case, making trouble for Syria and giving Syria a lot of grief when – as Mr. Anderson said, there's been a back-channel relationship. And by the way, Syria has been begging us in camera, in back-channel, to talk to them. We'll deal with you. Don't put it in our face. Syria has not been accused of any direct terrorism by the State Department in its annual terrorism report since 1986. The problem with Syria is that it still supports groups, Hamas, Jihad, and others that have committed terrible acts inside Israel. But it itself, the country itself, has not. And so this would seem to be a case where you put the ideology aside. You don't make implicit war on Syria. And you still deal with them on the real issue we have, which isn't addressed, I don't think, by the war in Iraq, which is, what are we going to do about al-Qaeda? That's disappeared. Where is Mullah Omar?
Okay.
Where is Osama bin Laden? Et cetera.
Well, I'm sure we're going to get to that through calls and so on about we've got just a little time before the break, and I wonder, Cy, if you could just sort of sense, we talk about back-channel intelligence. Do we have a sense of what kind of information that is that's coming? We say back-channel intelligence. We assume it's about, al-Qaeda. But, have you got some more detail on
Sure.
what it is?
Well, one thing, for example, Syria penetrated. During the 1980s, the German intelligence allowed the Muslim Brotherhood, sort of a precursor of al-Qaeda. They work together now. The Muslim Brotherhood, a very anti-Iraq operation, to operate inside Germany. The Germans, in a way, let it happen because in the Iran-Iraq war, the Germans supported Iraq and Syria supported Iran. Syria began penetrating the Brotherhood in the 80s. And by the 90s, it was running companies as fronts to which people like Mohammed Atta were employed. So they had tremendous information. In one specific case, they learned about a pending attack on a Navy base in the Middle East, in Bahrain, and with the help of Syrian intelligence, we stopped it before it happened, and it could have been very deadly, involved a glider that you can't see with our radar systems, a glider full of explosives.
Cy, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. Hold your thoughts, Cy and Frank Anderson, because we're coming up to the break. That's what the music means. Connection listeners, do you think that the American intelligence services are being fairly or unfairly criticized for the several intelligence lapses in recent years? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection, and this is Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller speaking last weekend.
The reason that we're focused so much on this, let's say, the Niger incident, it's not because it's only 16 words. It's not because it's like this is politics. It's because if we are going to be in this complicated world that we are, and we're looking at Iran, we're looking at North Korea. North Korea, I agree, is far more dangerous, always was, than Iraq to us and our imminent security. Soldiers in South Korea, for example. People have to really trust all of that intelligence. They have to believe in it.
Senator Jay Rockefeller, Democrat of West Virginia. We're talking this hour, Connection listeners, about intelligence. We're talking about is the fitting of intelligence to suit political policy objectives a new phenomenon. We're also talking about whether the agencies, the CIA foremost among them, is getting unfair criticism. And we're talking about this with Cy Hirsch, veteran investigative reporter of The New Yorker magazine, who has yet another article in this week's issue. This one is about Syria. And we're also talking about this with Frank Anderson, Senior Vice President of Foreign Reports, a Washington consulting firm that concentrates on Middle East issues. And more importantly for our conversation, a veteran of the CIA. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. And we will be getting to your calls very shortly. But first, let me ask you, Frank Anderson, on this particular story, which we're all more aware of and which was dredged up by Cy Hirsch, what it seems to be fake reports on Iraqi attempts to buy this yellow cake uranium in Niger, as a veteran of the CIA, do you get just a little bit peeved that the CIA is being blamed for this and that George Tenet is carrying the can for this?
No, I can't say I get peeved. The following are sort of basic truths, and one of them is that politicians and policy wonks and intelligence professionals, and for that matter, practitioners in the throughout the executive branch and the military, have a fundamental difference of approach. And intelligence professionals and others deal with the world as it is, and those policy and people and politicians are seeking to construct a world that they want. No politician can win an election if he describes himself as better at managing the current status quo. He's got to offer a new vision. And this administration has a more coherent vision, and some of it was skilled politics and some of it was just events after 9/11 that have put him in position to execute this bold policy that is, if not unprecedented, hasn't been seen since Teddy Roosevelt.
I suppose one man's coherent vision is another man's doctrinaire inflexibility. I mean that seriously. I mean,
yes.
I take it that you as a professional would actually then prefer to work with an administration, and over the course of your career, you worked with several different administrations, that actually knows precisely what it wants rather than one that's sort of looking to you to help shape what it wants.
Well, in terms of my personal preference, I'm not even sure what my personal preference is because I've watched all kinds of administrations over the years in the agency, but there's a significant difference. I think the real difference between this administration and its predecessors, rather than having to do with its ideology, has to do with the unique experiences after 9/11. Before 9/11 and going all the way back to the end of World War II, the foreign policy and national security infrastructure of the United States had built up and operated in a way that the career professionals, or if you want to use the outside term, bureaucrats, acted almost as another check and balance in our system. There was a very deliberative process in which the intelligence professionals at that working level and sort of mid-level managers would get together in working groups, and they would funnel both intelligence judgments and policy recommendations up through the National Security Council managed process that would, in most times, end up with a deputies committee, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, the Deputy Secretary of State, the number two guy at CIA, and the Vice Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff, making the critical decisions and then pushing them up to the President and the principals of the National Security Council for their almost rubber stamp of these things. And that deliberative process, frankly, was one in which I grew up, and so I was more comfortable with it. Since 9/11, the real change is that event brought the president and his key cabinet members together on a daily basis. And these guys made policy and pushed it down through that mechanism rather than waiting for it to come up.
Cy Hirsch, do you agree that change is the big one that's taken place?
Oh, categorically. The difference is, look, in the old days, nothing was given to the president that – nothing significant was given to the president that wasn't vetted, a wonderful Washington word, wasn't fully staffed out and evaluated by somebody in the CIA, nothing of significance. There was always a CIA input. The idea – that somebody like Ahmed Chalabi in the Iran, you know, the Iraqi National Congress, this guy that we've been that Rumsfeld and others have been pushing for years, this outsider, would generate defectors, defective reports that would be generated from the Pentagon into the White House into public statements, without the CIA having a chance in advance to go through them and vet to make sure they were accurate. We have a totally different world now. We have the policy driving the intelligence, and that's really what Mr. Anderson was saying. The policy is driving the intelligence. Look, we've been there before. During a break, we were talking about the fact that in the late 80s, Ronald Reagan was convinced Cuba was behind everything in Latin America and pushed real hard on the CIA to say that. People resigned then. There were resignations and people protesting. It's happened before, but never has so much pressure been put on the professionals to change intelligence, and never has so much ideology gone into assessments. And it's a disaster, really.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Doug is calling from Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I thought the Roosevelt quote was really telling about the people having to trust the intelligence community, and the comments just a few seconds ago about the fundamental difference between how the intelligence community operated in the past. I'm not so sure I agree with that, by the way, but how it operates now is really the basis for that. I think the intelligence community has lost its series of options, and many of us feel as though it is the sort of secret private propaganda arm of the administration. And I'm mindful that some intelligence people go kicking and screaming into that new philosophy, but I think there's no doubt that the philosophy is there. One perfect example is us all focusing on those infamous 16 words in the president's report, when in reality the report was full of lies. And the intelligence community is required to follow administration policy, and it's the fundamental reason why the intelligence community is not trusted by the vast majority of the American people.
Frank Anderson, would you like to respond to Doug on that point?
Well, there are a number of statements on which he made that I don't fundamentally agree. The intelligence community now always has been the servant of the policymakers, and frequently bites its tongue. And this isn't just this administration or the past. It bites its tongue when politicians make statements that intelligence professionals wouldn't support. It's also been the case in the past that the intelligence professionals tended to be wrong. They were wrong and the policymakers were right. In my own case, when I was working on it, running penetrations of Palestinian terrorist organizations, I underestimated the degree to which there was Soviet and Eastern European participation in terrorism. It wasn't quite the terror network which there was a book called Claire Sterling in the late 1970s or early 80s, I can't remember if it was 79 or 80, which laid out a picture of a coordinated Moscow-directed terrorist international, which turned out not to be the case. But quite frankly, it was more the case than my own down in the woods and in the trenches view had developed over the years. So the intelligence community is not always right. I think it is appropriate, it's proper, it's necessary that there be this tension between politicians who are focused on the world as they wish to make it and intelligence professionals who keep pushing into their face, or should keep pushing into their face, the world as it is.
You know, we don't all like that, but I still maintain that that's really not the case, at least anymore. We can talk about post 9/11 or pre 9/11, but it seems to me, and a lot of folks I talk to, that the hierarchical system is in place here. And if the intelligence community doesn't agree with what the administration's spin is, then it damn well better go out and find a way to make it so. At least that's the impression that's that's being given.
That's getting out into the country at large. Doug, I want to thank you for your call. Cy Hirsch, it's a matter of where you look in on the story. I mean, you could say that we're all a bunch of blind men feeling up an elephant on this one. But to pick up Frank Anderson's point about he was presumably seated so close running a Middle East station that perhaps he couldn't step back far enough to see a bigger picture, different contours in the land. I mean, do you acknowledge that where you look at it as a reporter, the place where you set yourself to look into a story will often affect what you're actually seeing?
Well, of course. I mean, I think what Mr. Anderson was saying, the implicit assumption, the assumption he makes is of normality and regularity on both sides and integrity on both sides. In other words, perhaps underestimated something, and the other side, the politicians were correct in their view. And the assumption is that the politicians are judgmentally reasonable, rational, constantly interested in what would be the best for everybody in the world. And in this administration, it's not clear. The other word you can use for this administration is extremely radical. It's an extremely radical administration in trying to change the way the world is shaped and sort of taking on 1.2 million billion Muslims. So when you're dealing with a radical group that isn't as interested in the process as I think people in the CIA are, and there's an imbalance, I think here's where we come to. I would venture to say, and this is just a heuristic thought, that probably the 12,000-page document that Saddam Hussein submitted to the UN, you know, in the end game a few months in January, I think, was probably September.
Yeah.
The 12,000-page dossier was probably more accurate about what was going on in terms of weapons of mass destruction than anything our leadership said, including Colin Powell in his UN testimony or statements in February. So when you have this happen, and you have an inability to see, and you so vilify the other guy and so eagerly, which nobody's defending Saddam Hussein, that isn't the point, but it's clearly something really went wrong in our system in the WMD, the weapons of mass destruction issue. And I don't think it's so much the CIA as that I think it is people in this administration lacking the integrity to deal honestly with the process.
Frank Anderson, my guess is you don't entirely agree with that. Do you want to come back?
Well, I'm not certain that they lack integrity. There is, I said, this is a group with a clear worldview, and it is ideological. They admit that it is. They have, for at least the moment, the ear and agreement of the president and the vice president. And while that's the case, every executive branch employee of the United States government is going to find him or herself working for that kind of an administration. The jury's still out on a number of issues about whether or not this kind of a clear and focused foreign policy direction is going to end up being in or not in our interest. We'll see what's happening in Iraq.
Connection listeners, let me ask you, as this conversation unfolds, another question poses itself. Who do you think has lost the most credibility in these last 90 days since the end of the war with the failure to find weapons of mass destruction? The intelligence community or the administration? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Russ is calling from Norfolk, Virginia.
Yes, another fellow in Norfolk. Listen, my take on this is, and this is my take only, we have not had since the Vietnam War enough what I call cowboys, since the beginning of the OSS, Wild Bill Donovan. We do not have the people that got the cojones to go over there and just over to the Middle East, and maybe it's our problem with Islam, but we depend on these quote-unquote good sources that we hear from over in the Middle East and all of that, and we need some damn people in the CIA that are willing to go over there and put their life on the line, which it just seems like young people or whatever who they're trying to recruit. We don't have the people over there putting their lives on the line.
Russ, I get your point. I'm going to say, well, for one thing, we don't have enough Arabic speakers, but I'm going to throw your comment to Frank Anderson. I mean, did you have that sort of – I think we all have an image of the kind of agent President Russ is talking about, when you were running stations in the Middle East, in the 1980s, did you have that kind of agent?
This is a subject that is going to arouse my passion directly. I would like to take the caller to Arlington Cemetery and have him visit the graves of brave subordinates and friends of mine who went there. Or I would have liked to have taken him back and forth across the Green Line in Beirut the numbers of times I made that trip. The United States is served very well by young people who come into that service. They are almost, without exception, people who walk away from jobs where they make far more money, and they certainly walk away from potential lives that are much richer in a material sense in order to serve their country. And they go to difficult and dangerous places, and they do outstanding work.
Cy Hirsch.
Well, I don't think I would also add that obviously I know a lot of people in the intelligence community, and believe me, most people in the intelligence community really want to do their job right, just like the rest of us, and try the very best. And I would say also I'd add to the military. Most people in the military care an awful lot. The officers I know, I don't know that many enlisted men. So I don't think, on the other hand, the difficulty of getting somebody, you know, a cowboy, as he put it, planted inside a radical group, it's a lot harder than you think. And some American guy, you really have to rely on third-party people. You have to rely on the people from those countries and from neighboring countries. And Frank, I know you. Most of the people you use would have to be foreign nationals that you try and obtain information for. You can't send an American boy and girl over there. It's just, you know, cowboy or not, it's not going to work.
Connection listeners, we're talking about the intelligence services, the U.S. intelligence services, we may even get to British intelligence services. Are they to be trusted? Who's lost most credibility in the period since the war in Iraq ended, or major combat operations ceased, I think is the phrase that's being used. The intelligence community or the administration? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking about intelligence this hour, Connection listeners. Our intelligence services, is fitting intelligence to suit policy objectives new? Who do you trust? Who's lost the most credibility in this period after the war is over, the administration or the CIA? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. And we're talking with Cy Hirsch, veteran investigative reporter, currently writing for The New Yorker magazine, and Frank Anderson, who's a veteran of the CIA and a consultant now for a firm that concentrates on Middle East issues. Frank Anderson, let me come to you. I mean, earlier in the program, so I was saying that the real important work for intelligence services now remains what it was before the war, which is finding out about al-Qaeda and these non-state players. Now, when you were working for the CIA, you had a range of tools because most of the people you were investigating were state players, yeah? And so you could, you know, you had diplomatic cover and so on. What's the new and more difficult tasks that face today's intelligence gatherers, you know, in the Middle East or anywhere on the face of the earth?
Well, and actually, my experience was different from my friends who were engaged in the Cold War directly against the Soviet Union or China. At least 50% or more of my work was non-state players. It was the terrorist organizations in the Middle East and elsewhere. Diplomatic cover has some distinct limits in terms that one of my predecessors said, you can't get our targets to show up at the embassy cocktail party. On the other hand, to the uninitiated, you have to recognize the different purposes of cover. When you deploy a person into a dangerous country or even an easy country, the first thing you need is cover for status. You need to have some reason for the person to be there that the local government will accept. And over the years, rightly or wrongly, the cheapest, most convenient way to do that is to put people in official American installations. It's certainly done in many places that people are there in non-official capacities. That's expensive, a little less efficient, but sometimes necessary. But the real work of intelligence is not going out and burglarizing the building in which the secret resides, but it is persuading the person who can get in there to bring out the secret. And that work involves people who can deal with these various kinds of target individuals and can deal with others who can get to them. Sometimes it's a chain using what in the trade is called an access agent. If you can't develop a way to have a relationship with a guy who lives in Fakani, which was the neighborhood controlled by the Palestinians in Beirut in the 1970s and 80s, your first move then is to find an Arab who lives there, who comes out, whom you can recruit and get on your side. The task is more difficult than sidling up to a foreign ministry person in a cocktail party, but it's not impossible, and it's certainly not one which you can abandon just because it's a little harder.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Sharon is calling from Brookfield, Massachusetts.
Hello. Thank you for this discussion. It's very important, Mr. Hirsch, for your incisive reporting, which in some aspects has been lacking in this issue, and for Mr. Anderson's being willing to let us in behind the door, so to speak. My question is, and I'm throwing this out to both of you, this discussion's been a little bit too abstract for my liking in that people are dying as a direct result of policies that have been initiated or in some cases ignored as a result of CIA intelligence. And I'd like both of you to comment on the fact that policy decisions as a result of CIA intelligence have direct ramifications on American troops, American policy, and people overseas as well. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Cy Hirsch?
I would say that it's really the policy is driven not by the CIA. I'm sure Ms. Anderson would say the same thing. This is a policy that's being driven by a small group. In one of my articles, I used the word cabal, eight or nine people with the same sort of ideas we're talking about, again, that the people would include Cheney and Rumsfeld and the president. He's certainly involved. And all of these people have sort of, I would say, the word I would use is hijacked a national policy. This is, the name of the game right now is to protect ourselves and try to come to terms with international terrorism and to try and to find ways of stopping it, obviously resolving the Middle East crisis between Israel and Palestine that the president is finally doing now, I would venture, mostly because of political reasons. I think the polls show that he needed to do something to show that he's not only trying to kill Arabs, and you're right, people are dying. But it's not, God, here I am defending the CIA. I have a lot of problems with the CIA and with George Tenet, but to lay this at the feet of the CIA is just wrong. I would venture the overwhelming percentages of senior officials think this policy is loony as I do.
Just a quick question, sir, because how is it that in terms of, I mean, I don't want to get too deep in the specifics of the Niger story. How is it that he felt, George Tenet, that he should take the blame for this? Was he told he should take the blame for this? Or I don't get that one, frankly.
Well, it's easy to get. I don't have any inside information. George Tenet is the president's man. He serves, and he was told that he was, you know, I think that's more significant for me was the fact that the press seemed to buy the story that the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, who is responsible for this stuff, can say, oh, the CIA misled me. The truth is, she's the one that when she made that amazing statement that Tenet is responsible, should have immediately been criticized and pilloried. That's her job, not his, to ascertain the integrity of the process there. And so, but Tenet is a loyal soldier. Everybody likes George Tenet. He's a very, very nice, amiable guy. I'm not sure he shouldn't have disappeared a long time ago simply because fresh people are needed. On the other hand, I think he would say, if I go, look out for what's going to come after me.
It's interesting, though. This administration does seem at the moment to be, you know, using the intelligence agencies as a scapegoat. I mean, there's a report out today about former Ambassador Wilson's wife Now, have you read about this?
Sure.
You read about this? I mean, it seems to me quite extraordinary. I mean, Frank is a former member of the CIA, and he's out about some of what he was up to during his career in the CIA. But to say that someone's wife used to work for the CIA is to reveal some piece of information that not necessarily some people who work for the CIA want revealed. Why do that? Frank Anderson.
Well, this isn't the first time it's happened, and my response to it is, well, I don't know the facts, but let me operate on the assumption that the charge that has been made has a basis, and that is that someone provided information to a journalist about a person undercover. That's immoral, illegal, and needs to be investigated, and if the investigation proves that that misdeed occurred, that needs to be sanctioned severely. And I come to this from the position of a person who once had to leave I left Beirut because I'd been outed in a magazine, which was no big deal. That happened to a lot of people. But some of our Eastern European, new European friends now provided my photograph to a group of Palestinians, and it caused me some minor inconvenience. I left town early. This is beyond the pale.
800.
Let me just say one thing as a reporter. I can't tell how many times that I worked for the New York Times, and even now at the New Yorker, people in the government have asked me not to write about certain individuals. And of course we respect that, because anybody who's doing his job, no journalist wants to jeopardize anybody. And so the idea that she's not, the woman they're talking about is still in undercover. She wasn't publicly known. So they outed somebody who's still in a very sensitive job in the CIA, a most sensitive job right now. And for these guys, it's just probably, I'm talking about the ideologues, it's just another means to whatever the objective they have that day. So I'm not sure how concerned they're going to be about it.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Gus is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts.
Hello?
Gus.
Yes, hello?
Hi.
Hi. Okay, what I wanted to say was that I have no problem with the CIA intelligence as it's been coming out. If you've been looking for the information, you can find it, in the very back of the paper, buried in a little article. It refutes, everything that the administration was saying, that there's no credible evidence that there are weapons of mass destruction. There's no credible evidence that ties Saddam Hussein to 9/11. There's no credible evidence that he's trying to acquire weapons of mass destruction. But that information was always buried. So I don't feel that it's a failure of the CIA intelligence gathering community. What I really feel is that the administration, is lacking something, to go back to what you were saying earlier. But what they lack is the ability to change their minds. I really feel that President Bush decided that he was going to punish someone for 9/11, and he chose Iraq, and it didn't matter how much contrary evidence was presented, he was determined, then that was it. That was his course of action, and no amount of contrary evidence was going to sway him from that course of action.
Gus, let me stop you there and put this point to Cy Hirsch. Was it, in your view, Cy, 9/11 that motivated the march to war on Saddam Hussein, or was it something else?
Well, 9/11 gave the ticket the ride. It made it possible. A group of people, Paul Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld and others, had been writing and complaining since the end of the first Gulf War that we'd made a terrible mistake, that Saddam Hussein was the root of all evil, and he had been high on their target list. And I do know empirically from people who were in the White House in the national security apparatus on the evening of 9/11. The president was not there, but Cheney was, and Iraq was coming up immediately. And I'm friends of mine who actually participated in National Security Council meetings have told me they were stunned at the quickness with which they raced to Iraq. So 9/11 gave them the ticket to ride. That's what it was. And enabled all of this ideology to come blazing out in a political way that was palatable. And Bush was, and still remains very popular for being strong and taking aggressive action in retribution for this terrible incident that happened.
I wonder sometimes if the foreign division of the Mukhabarat in Baghdad back in 2001 read an article by your colleague Nick Lehman at the
New Yorker in January 2001, I think, about what a Bush foreign policy might look like. I think they might have found a lot of planning on an attack on that regime. And that was in January 2001, not September. But we're coming to the end of the hour, and too fast, I fear. Let me quickly ask you, Frank Anderson, the WMD question is simply not going to go away. As a professional, what is, and you know, you're no longer in the CIA, do you think that WMDs will turn up? Do you think that the whole raison d'etre for war being placed on WMD was a wise idea? And I hate to ask you that big question with 2 minutes left in the show, but I have to.
Well, with 2 minutes, I hate to give you the answer that all intelligent professionals hates, and that is beats the heck out of me.
But thanks.
But I will, in the administration's defense, make the following statement, and that is that notwithstanding the question of their capability as of early 2003, the Iraqis had in the past of a policy of seeking weapons of mass destruction to which they would not, their purposes for which were not benign. They had a policy in the past of threatening their neighbors. They certainly had a well-established policy of using and providing support and shelter to terrorist organizations. And they were internally a vicious, bloodthirsty and bloody institution, and I don't mourn their passing. I just worry about whether or not the cost which we will pay will turn out to be the right one, and whether or not we've prepared ourselves to manage the post-conflict.
Frank Anderson, thanks very much. And Cy Hirsch, an even shorter answer from you. Just yes or no,
Are you surprised about the WMD thing?
Not a chance.
I'll say none in 12 years. I think he's pulled one of the most amazing shell games on all of us. And by the way, the CIA never said they were there. Caveated it.
Cy Hirsch, thank you very, very much. Cy Hirsch is the staff writer for The New Yorker, an article on Syria and American intelligence contacts in this week's issue of The New Yorker. Frank Anderson, thank you very, very much, former CIA operations officer. The show sound earlier, we had a quote from Jay Rockefeller, came from CNN's late edition. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. My apologies to all our callers. We had great calls. We simply didn't have time to get to you all. I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.